listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 233 of the DIY Musician Podcast, where on today's episode, we're going to be talking about building a powerful set list. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how are you?
Doing good. I'm excited to be heading tomorrow to Boston for the Berklee College of Music on-site conference, which is always fun.
Yes. And by the time people hear this,
it'll be over.
It'll probably be over.
I'll be home again, yeah.
Yeah. I'm heading to France for the MEDEM conference, and I'll probably post this. Maybe I'll be home before I post this, but we'll see.
As far as
anyone listening knows, it's happening tomorrow anyway.
Right. MEDEM, that's a little further away than Boston for me.
Yeah, I'm taking one for the team and going to Cannes in the south of France.
Yeah, that's a real sacrifice.
I drew the short straw on that
one. The Mediterranean.
Yeah.
I hear terrible things.
It's tough. Life's hard. Before we jump right into the topic, just a reminder that the DIY Musician Conference tickets are on sale. DIYMusicianCon.com. And one of the top questions we've been getting asked is, are there still opportunities to perform? As you may have heard us say, that if you bought early bird tickets, you got advance access to some performance opportunities. Sadly, that time has passed, but there's still hope. There are plenty of performance slots that will be given out at the conference itself. In the past, we've done two nights of open mic. This year, we have three nights of open mic. Every night at this venue called Cheer Up Charlie's, which has two stages. It's a great spot. It's going to be a nice time there every night at the conference. And our friends over at Shure Microphones, which I am talking into a Shure microphone right as we speak, they are going to be doing an open mic during the day in the conference where you'll be able to sign up. They bring a nice setup and, it's another opportunity for you to play, and there'll be people in there listening as well. And we also have our jam room, which is also a great opportunity to just get out there and jam and collaborate. And, you know, when I think of a jam room, I always think of, for some reason, some dude playing a guitar solo that goes way too long and nobody cares. That's not what this is. In fact, it is pretty amazing. It blew my mind what cool stuff happens in the jam room. It's fun, it's exciting, it's energetic, and a lot of people collaborating. So I've seen people meet and decide to work on music together just in the jam room at our conference. I think one of the videos we have is there was like 40 people in the jam room singing Hey Jude. There was like 20 guitars, all sorts of other instruments, people singing. It's a lot of fun. So there are plenty of opportunities for you to perform at the conference still. And there may be more that pop up. We're still looking for other opportunities, and sponsors are coming in and having ideas of how they want to use their sponsorship. And some of it, you know, performance opportunities are being discussed. So get your ticket, DIYMusicianCon.com. Right now it's $129. At the end of June, it's going to go up again. So get in now because you want to be there. So why pay more for something you want to do when you know you want to do it? Just go get it now.
Yeah. I'm going to say yes to all of that. But really what I'm still fixated on is your seamless product plug for sure. That was well done.
Which part? The whole part?
No, when you said, I'm recording on a Shure microphone right now.
I am. I'm going to have to tell them that they're going to have to bump up their sponsorship a little bit.
Right.
This has been, this microphone, it's been one of the go-to mic for me on this podcast for, I don't know, maybe 10 years.
Wow.
It's a Shure KSM 23 or 27, something. You've seen it in pictures. If you follow me on Instagram, you've seen it. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, anyways, I diverted from the topic of the conference, but the schedule is online on DIYMusicianCon.com. You can see, it's not the complete schedule, but it's getting filled out.
Yeah, you can see a lot of the speakers, a lot of the sessions, and we're still filling a few things out, but it's getting pretty close and it's really exciting. Lots of cool stuff. As a reminder, we did sort of think of three tracks this year, of a make track, a market track, and a monetization track. And it's not like you have to choose one, but we just kind of grouped things in those categories to guide our programming. So there's a lot more on the make side this year, and definitely some cool stuff on the markets and monetization side as well. So DIYMusicianCon.com, and we'll see you in Austin, August 16th through 18th. Well, today's episode came from a listener. They emailed a question, and I said, you know what? That sounds like an excellent show. And so we are going to talk about that.
These things practically write themselves.
They do practically write themselves. So we are going to talk about building a powerful set list. Now, I'll read that email in a second, but also remind you that later on in the show, we have more listener questions, feedback, and calls. And I figured the name episode would strike a chord, so we have a few about that. I feel like that's going to be a theme for a while. Stick around for that later on in the show. But let's get into this topic about building a powerful set list. I'm going to read the email that we received first, and then we'll dive right in.
Cool.
So it says, hey guys, I'm a CD Baby artist, and I've recently discovered the DIY Musician podcast and have become a huge fan of the content you all are bringing to the table. I was wondering if you could give some tips on putting together a set list. How far in advance do you put one together for the gig? Does it change? If so, how often? And other details like that. Also, I want to note that I'm a jazz musician, so could you also give perspective as a listener regarding what you would want to hear from a jazz concert? For me and my jazz colleague friends, we can listen to everything or just the same thing over and over again and still lose our minds over what's happening. This makes me often second guess whether my set list song choices are engaging to the audience. I know it's wise to change up the style throughout, swing to Latin feel to something modal and mellow, but how much is too much and how little is too little? Thank you for the work that you both do with the podcast and at CD Baby. I look forward to any thoughts you have on this matter. Blessings, Austin Morgan. And he's a trumpet player. And so, Austin, this episode is dedicated to you. This one goes out to Austin.
This one goes out to Austin.
Trumpet player.
You know what I love most about this question is his doubting of his own skills or qualifications in determining the set list, which I think I'm legitimately praising him. I think it's a healthy thing to realize that just because he's a musician who's going to geek out about all the technical stuff, that for your average listener, they have a very different experience of a concert. So I like that he's approaching it with that kind of skepticism of his own set lists.
Yeah. And I also like it that it wasn't, I'm a rock band, even though we're going to talk about that kind of stuff, but this is about like more about the song choices that we're going to be talking about today and things that you can do with the songs you put together for your set. So this is going to be different than the Tom Jackson thing about creating moments and where you're standing on stage and how you're moving and creating pressure. And you can go listen to those episodes. We have two of them. Just look them up, and those are great. And that's something totally different. This, we're actually going to talk about the thought process behind putting together a good grouping of songs that make for a good evening of music, and the different types of scenarios that you might be finding yourself in where you need different set lists. So I think it's going to be a fun discussion.
I think so too. I love this topic.
You know, it's funny because when I read this, it is like, you know, a lot of the bands that I've played with, it's always that thing, either sitting in the green room before you go out on to play, like, we need to put together a set list.
So everyone gets their own napkins out with the Sharpies and you're comparing notes and, right.
Or sometimes, you know, having it dialed in and prepared, but it's like, you know, it's one of those things that it kind of feels like a chore at times. I don't know why it's so hard, but we're going to dissect that a little. So do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Well, I have a question. Are we starting with kind of defining the different sorts of sets you could even perform? Is that how we're going to kick it off?
I think that's important because, you know, I think if people who saw the title of the episode or said heard we were going to talk about set list, their mind probably immediately jumped to that 45-minute club show set list. But there are so many more different types of sets that all of us are playing. And strategically, your best tool to conquer that evening is the songs you choose.
Right.
So, yeah, you want to hit that,
yeah,
start us down that
list? Yeah, so the one you just mentioned, that sort of prime slot of the 45-minute club show where you're playing, presumably, like, mostly or all originals, there's that. But then we, you know, us singer-songwriters certainly know that there's the three-hour cover song gig. And bands obviously play those too, wedding gigs, just your average cover band night. So those long, long evenings of three or four sets of music. There can be one that's like more of like a two-hour original gig, which is, you know, I think what people playing 45-minute shows aspire to get to, where it's really their show and everyone's there to see them. So they get an hour and a half or 2 hours to shape their own concert. You had written on here, jazz band. I'm not sure what you mean by that. But
I was referring to his email.
Okay, well, I generally think of jazz shows as, you know, longer. I could be wrong, and maybe I've been out of the jazz scene for too long, but an hour and a half to 3 hours of music with maybe an intermission or something. That's kind of what I think of as a jazz show.
Yeah, I think also when I put that there, relating it back to Austin's email, that also for a jazz show, there's a more of the expectation from the audience could be different, or how they act in that scenario could be different. Then, you know, maybe you're playing for a dinner crowd, or maybe you're playing for people that are at a nice cocktail bar and they're sitting there listening and they're there to hear jazz, where some of those 2 hour or other gigs, it may be people that are just at a venue. They may be there to hear you, but like, I know that a lot of jazz clubs and people playing that circuit, the people that are there may not be there to see you specifically, but they're there to hear jazz.
Yeah, that's true. There's a kind of
like, could be another genre that you sub in there, that there, but there are some genres where people show up and they're there to hear that genre.
Yeah, there's like the dedicated audience is kind of like a connoisseur. They show up for that reason. Yeah, so that's good to mention. There's also, I like how you wrote this, stuck in the corner gig, which, I mean, there's a lot of ways you can be stuck in the corner. It could be one of those 3 hour cover song gigs. It could be you're in the corner. I've seen people playing at Potbelly's sandwich shop and like Starbucks and stuff. And to me, they seem like they're stuck in the corner. But
yeah, it's that place where you're probably playing it at something that's not necessarily a music venue. Or some place that's trying to have music, but maybe not a music venue. I could even throw in like some things like farmers markets and stuff like that there.
Totally. Yeah. And then I was thinking about open mics, which can be, you know, a mini little set list. A lot of open mics, you get two or three songs or, you know, like 10 to 15 minute slots. And that can be its own sort of stressful set list where you're like, I got to cram it all in. What am I going to do? So I thought that was worth mentioning. And then there's like the kind of mini set that's, I don't know, 25 minutes maybe, where it's like you might be opening, you know, the opener for the opener on some big tour, or it could be like a battle of the bands where your time limit's 20 minutes, or like short festival sets, just kind of like, it's not quite 45 minutes, but it's not quite the three songs you do in an open mic. It's kind of in between. House concerts is something I'm really interested in with set lists, because it's a completely different atmosphere from a club, for one. And that can either mean people are more comfortable, like lounging in the couch, or it could mean that they're sitting on really uncomfortable plastic chairs. And you have to be kind of mindful of what their comfort level is physically. So it's like, and I think we're going to talk about this later, but it's like, do you play for 45 minutes, take a little break, and then play another 20, 30 minutes? Or do you just plow through and do 60 or 70 minutes of music and then call it a night? And the last one I was thinking of is a songwriter in the round evening, where like you really only get control of like a third or a fourth of the songs. And part of what might make the night successful is that you're flexible enough to like bounce off the song that came before. So you're not doing another, you know, song that's similar to the previous songwriter.
Yeah, I think that covers most of it. I'm sure there's some things we missed, some scenarios not there. I mean, we don't have Walmart on here, the men's clothing section of Walmart.
Right. How long were those gigs you were doing, by the way?
Oh, they felt like an eternity. But
they're still going on in some alternate dimension.
Yeah, in my mind, they haven't ended. We were there usually like an hour. It felt long. And near the end of doing those, we started to just drop in and cut out faster. But yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So yes, there are other places that you could be playing and performing, but this covers a lot of the typical places that we find ourselves playing and having to put together a set list and try and understand what the right type of music or the mix of music that'll make the evening a success.
Indeed.
So
musicians, I'm thinking back on this list, musicians have a lot of different options and modes of presenting their music.
Well, how do you want to tackle this? I mean, because we have some other things to say about it, like more strategic things. Where do you want to dive into this list?
Here's where I would start then. I'll just start it. I feel like the environment. So for one thing, we've already discussed the different durations of time that you could be expected to fill. But I think the other thing, like picking up on the house concert thing, is like the environment can shape your set list. So like I've played outdoor shows where for some reason, and I guess it's acoustics, it pays off to play way more energetic stuff because it's something that just gets lost in translation as the sound waves escape into the air or something. But like if you're in a smaller room, I feel like you can sometimes get away with playing moodier, slower stuff. If you're in a big room that's empty, you know, there's all these sort of just environmental factors. How many people are in the room? Is it a small room? Is it a big room? Is it full? Is it empty? All of that really affects how I approach a set list.
That's a good point, because when you play outside, which happens a lot, you know, farmers markets, outdoor festivals, it could be an amazing show. In fact, one of the weirdest experiences I've had on a stage is to be on a stage. The largest concert we played to was like about 100,000 people. And that sounds like, oh, that sounds so amazing. Actually, it felt like there was nobody there because they're so far away from you, because there's this, you know, gap between, on a festival stage that big, there's like a VIP section down front and press section. And then there's the front row people, and you can't hear anything from them because there's no, you know, you don't hear that energy and noise back from the crowd. And the stage felt really dead, even though the sound system was blasting an enormous amount of sound out front. It was just really weird. And it felt like there was no energy. And so when you're outside, it really can be a challenge just to learn how to play outside and adjust to that energy. But yeah, like choosing a set that is more energetic, because there's not that natural room energy that makes things feel more exciting. That could be something that's more helpful. Like, you know, if you're outside and you play slow singer-songwriter stuff, it might feel extra slow. You might want to throw in some upbeat stuff, or that might be a good time to throw in a cover that takes the place of that.
Yeah.
And adds that energy.
Well, so I mean, I feel like all of this is pointing towards something we'll address later, but like having a certain amount of flexibility in your set list so that you can make those adjustments. Like maybe you planned your perfect set and you've rehearsed it that way and it's worked in a lot of contexts, but suddenly you're in a different kind of venue, a different kind of environment, and it's not translating as well. It's not, for some reason, it's not connecting. Like it pays to be able to say, you know what, like if it's a lot easier to do if you're a solo performer, you can just change. If you have a band, there's more moving pieces, but like to have the band be able to shift and play a different kind of song or is wise. And I think I talked about this like a year ago, I think, but I played this one cover song gig in a I guess, kind of like a small to medium-sized bar that had a dance floor. And it was packed. And I felt like I was on top of the world. Like, it was killing. Like, 3 hours of just perfection and energy. And listeners of the podcast might remember. But then 2 days later, I went and played the exact same set list at a slightly larger venue that was not quite as full because it was a Monday night. And I felt like a complete failure. I questioned all my life decisions. It was like, I don't know. It was not landing. And afterwards, my friend came up and was like, dude, what's with all the depressing songs? And I'm like, wait, this is the same like upbeat, uplifting, poppy, dancey set I played the other night. What do you mean depressing? Like literally the same. Three hours in the same order, completely different effects. So in that case, I should have started reading the room and making some changes.
Yeah, so well, actually, let's dive into that 3 hour cover song gig, because that's what you're talking about right now, right?
Yeah, totally.
I have some questions, and I know you've done these a lot. I have not, so I have questions for you.
Okay.
Is it okay to repeat a song? Like you're building out a set list, and you're like 3 hours. The chances of the people in that first hour being around at the end. Is it okay that if I've got a song that I feel like was one that tends to connect with people that I repeat it a couple times?
So I have done it. So I'm not going to say no, but I also have I've played in rooms where like it's a bunch of strangers and I impress them and they're in, they get locked in, they stick around the whole time. And then it feels weird. It feels like suddenly I'm some sort of unprepared huckster or something to return to something they've already heard. So I would say if you can avoid it. And maybe just if there's only one song in your set that you know is going to kill, like maybe get some more songs like that instead of relying on just the one song you need to repeat. But yes, I've done it. So
how about this question? Here's my next question about the 3 hour cover song gig, because I know you do these and I've seen one where you occasionally you'll throw in an original.
Mm-hmm.
And is it okay to repeat the original? Because you're doing mostly covers and
I'm still going to say no.
Okay.
I mean, what do I know? I'm sure plenty
you're the expert. You're on the podcast.
Yeah, right.
I'm interviewing you right now.
No. So yes, it's fine, but try not to do it. Like, I don't know. I feel like it just feels weird when you get that far into a set and then it's like, oops, I ran out of songs. Or you're just whipping out it again because you know it's like the, what do you call it?
The hit?
The hit, the ringer, the thing that you can rely on. It's like, well, just get more songs like that.
Well, that's why I was wondering, because in a cover song gig, you know, it takes people a couple times to hear a song before they latch on to it and connect with it. And maybe they like the second time, if they were there for 3 hours, they're like, man, you played a song. I think you played it twice. I really dug it. I wasn't sure who it was. And then you go, oh, that was me.
Oh, that was me. And basically then what you're doing is the equivalent of why we like anything we hear on the radio, because it's like been drilled into our brain multiple times.
Yeah, that's my point.
You're like, yeah, this is like the guerrilla warfare version of...
Yeah. I'm playing Don't Stop Believin' for you, so you will stick around to hear my song, and then I'll tell you I'm going to play Don't Stop Believin' again in an hour, and then I'll play my song again.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, I guess certainly if someone requests a song again, like that is fine, but...
So when you're playing that 3 hour cover song gig, how do you approach putting together the set? What kind of songs are you drawing on? What, I mean, are you going to standard covers that are like all time top hits, or what are you doing?
So to try to balance my own enjoyment and amusement with the needs of the people at the venue. But I try to do, first of all, my rule is I won't cover anything I don't actually like or respect. Like, so I'm not going to lean on like Wagon Wheel and Margaritaville and like whatever. So like, that's the first rule. Like, I'm not like a cover song person that knows all the like typical cover song things, or if I do, I'm not going to play them. So I am fine playing almost anything that's like in my repertoire, like whether it's more dinner music, which, you know, I've got some like American songbook standard type things from the 40s and 50s, and I've got like modern pop like Sia and Taylor Swift and Katy Perry and whatever, like that sort of stuff, Ed Sheeran, like, and I'm happy with anything in between, the Beatles, classic rock, 80s stuff. So I try to have like enough songs from each era or whatever you'd say, or each mood, that I could do like an hour and a half of any particular like thing. And then what I do is like, I'll make a set list. So on one side I'll have the set list, and then on the other, next to it, I'll have sort of my song list. So if I need to make adjustments in real time, I easily just have a brain refresher and can pull songs in. Because what I don't want to happen is like script two dance songs and then some ballad. But meanwhile, like that means everyone's on the dance floor or whatever, having a good time. And now I'm going to like pull the rug out. Like I need to just keep the dance going a little longer. So that kind of flexibility is good. And then I also treat it like for my own comfort level, I guess. I never feel like I should just show up at one of those gigs and then be like in people's face, like volume wise or with the songs, and be like really energetic. Like I'm not like, I'm playing a cover song gig. I'm not a rock star. So I try to sort of first sort of sneak in some low volume stuff, like things that I'm comfortable performing. And then like kind of when you're laughing, what are you laughing at me?
No, I'm laughing because you said sneak in. And I just had this image of you like sneaking into the venue. Like you're not even supposed to be there. I just like to sneak in and start playing at a low volume. And next thing they know, like who hired this guy coming? The dude in the corner playing covers. I guess we'll let him stay.
Yeah. And then at the end of the night, I hope the manager noticed me and pays me. No, but like basically like the other thing is like these things tend to start at an hour when it's like there's no clear delineation often between like this is happy hour drinking time or this is dinner time. Okay. And now it's music time. Like that doesn't really happen. So you have to kind of flow without being like obnoxiously interrupting the vibe that's been there. Cause then people will be offended and want to leave. So I tend to try to do that thing, sneak in. And then after like four or five songs, I'll up the energy, up the volume, and kind of get to more poppy, dancey stuff. And at that point, either they, you know, don't like me and left, but I think generally they're like, oh, this guy is good. Okay, cool. Like they feel comfortable with me in the background. So now they're more willing to let me be a part of their night. And like, I feel like for me, that works way better. And then those people stick around. And so by the end of the night, the bars tend to be more full because I didn't just do the full on assault right from the start.
Yeah. Well, there's something I like about your approach to this gig. And I know we've spent a lot of time on this one, but I know a lot of our listeners are actively getting this gig a lot. And some of the common complaints I hear are, it's fine and actually paying me and I make money, but they're not hearing my music enough or they're not hearing about my story. But what I like about which your approach is like the way you pull artists that you either respect or I think fit with the kind of music you do is that you can use that as an opportunity to tell people, talk about why you chose that particular song. If they're listening, it's, you know, this is one of those gigs that could be like total background music to everyone's paying attention and right there with you. So, I mean, it's not wrong to say a few words about the songs you're playing.
Oh no, totally. Although I do, in the same way, I'm kind of reluctant at first to push too much energy stuff onto the audience. I'd wait to talk. I kind of want to like win them over simply by just being a nice musical part of whatever else they had going on. And then I'm happy talking after that, but yeah, totally. Connecting it to your own personal life or music is totally fine.
I would totally agree with you in this scenario that, the later it goes, that's when you have, I feel like the opportunity to open it up a little bit more and you've earned a little bit more respect and maybe credibility from the people there that then it's like, yeah, I've been here a while. This guy's good. Okay. Now he's going to say a thing or two. I would agree with that in this case. The last thing I'll ask you is in these cover song gigs, when you're putting together the set list, are you typically doing the songs like people are familiar with, or are they all your own take on them?
That depends. I mean, for one, it's just me and an acoustic guitar and some vocal processing, like, you know, harmony pedals or looping my voice. So just simply transferring the instrumentation, I think, changes it enough that maybe it feels like a unique interpretation. But generally, I feel like I'm kind of sticking to the structure and the melodies and tempos as they exist. For the most part. I mean, I'm not trying to like throw people for a loop too much. Also, like, I get a kick out of doing like female pop songs, but then in my own voice, like, so it's like Katy Perry down an octave with like a gruff male vocal on it. And then I'll like jump up to the falsetto, which is suddenly like, I hope like a joke everyone's in on instead of people laughing at me suddenly singing all high. But, so I don't know.
Well, I've seen you do that multiple times and it's always a crowd pleaser, but like, I'm thinking of, a friend of ours who listens to the podcast, Melody. She played me a version of Creep. She has this, I think it's called a gitalele. It's like half ukulele, half guitar. I don't know. It's a weird thing. And she said she does it kind of to be funny, but she played it for me. And I thought, it was such an amazing version of that song, but took it in a totally different direction that almost made it hers. So I don't know if in that case, for a cover song gig, if I would go that far out. I don't know. It might work for one or two, but it felt like it was like one of those things where I told her she needed to release it. Melody, if you're listening, you should still release that, because it was... because a female singing this song that was like written by a 20-year-old angsty person, but like wanting a girl to like him. But when you have a female who's a little older than that singing it, it changed the nature of the lyrics in an amazing way. And so that way I was like, I don't know if that falls into the cover song gig or not. Like if that's too far out and the people in that situation are going to not like it.
Well, so I don't know. I have two thoughts about that. For one, if you're doing 3 hours of covers and a lot of them are pretty faithful and everyone's enjoying your stuff, that I think they would totally go with you for a few departures like that. But that also sounds like the perfect one cover song to throw into like a 45-minute set of originals. If it's
it definitely
her
is.
Own, but I had two more thoughts I was going to throw in about the long covers things. So
all right.
Another reason to hold off on hitting hard with the energy is simply just to save up those songs, because as people get more drunk and you prove yourself more and they buy into your music, they're going to get out on the dance floor at the, towards the middle to the end of the night more readily than they will earlier. And you don't want to run out of songs and get in that situation you asked about where you have to repeat things. So saving the energetic stuff and kind of back loading it or whatever you'd say is smart. The other funny thing for me and nice thing, the reason I love doing these shows so much is because I don't need them and I don't do them that much. So like it might be once every 2 or 3 months I play one of these shows. So it's not the type of thing where I'm playing cover gigs 5 nights a week and I'm sick to death of the situation. For me, it's like a chance to play my favorite songs in front of a crowd in a different context where I'm not worried about, will they like my own music and my lyrics? Cause it's mostly other people's stuff. So it feels like this great relief. I had a point to mentioning that. Oh, so what happens is I end up having so much fun that I'm like who's the guy that breaks the union, boycott, the scab. Is that what you call him?
Yes, I think so.
So if a bunch of people are on strike and then there's the one guy that goes to work, like y'all hate him. I'm a little bit worried that I'm seen like that, because when I do these 3 hour cover gigs, I sometimes end up playing for 4.5 hours and like take one break. And so like the managers are always like, oh, sweet. Like you just filled 4.5 hours of time, literally with hardly any breaks. I'm paying you as much as I pay all these other people in town. So I'm setting bad precedents for everyone else who does this for a living.
I could see the subject line of a article on the Hard Times being artist in Maine intentionally smiles during 3 hour cover song gig.
Yeah. Continues smiling for an extra hour and a half for free. That is a great website, by the way. Everyone needs to check that out. What is it? Hardtimes.com?
Yeah. Thehardtimes.com. It's a parody site, or it sometimes feels all too real. They parody music and entertainment stuff, but there's been some articles there where I'll usually open it up Friday here at the office. There's where I've just burst out laughing and like crying because it was so funny. All right, let's. I think that's a lot of good information about putting together a set list for a 3-hour cover song gig. Let's jump into the one that Austin wrote about, the jazz artist. And I will say that he says, looking back at his email, he says his jazz colleagues and friends, they can listen to everything and just like, they're just eating it up. They're all like, this is amazing. Everything's amazing. I will say that I have a healthy respect for jazz. You might catch me listening to jazz every once in a while. I particularly like Dixieland jazz, if anyone is interested. So occasionally I might listen to some old jazz records or some new jazz records. But I'm not a jazz aficionado by any stretch of the imagination. So I feel like I am in the right camp to answer his question about putting together a jazz set list that might reach people that are not into jazz or not the diehard jazz people that just want to see the saxophone player play a million notes every song. First off, I would say definitely, he asked about changing up the styles and stuff. The one thing that when I've gone to jazz concerts, when I, as a non-jazz aficionado, I feel like when the set does have that sameness, it gets really hard to listen to after a while. Not because the songs aren't good, but because it's a lot to take in. I feel like those situations have been when it's been really upbeat or at least a lot of soloing. And I feel like my ear never gets a chance to just hear one note for more than a bar. And it starts to get tiresome.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Well, it becomes that thing when there's no real clear hook, like in a pop song. It's like, come on, just get to the chorus. Sort of like you want jazz players to have a motif that gets repeated enough for it to sink in before they leave and start soloing for 9 minutes and then maybe come back to it once. It's like, can there be a little bit more of a compositional element to this before things depart and go into the clouds?
Yeah. And you know, you can have those songs. Here's what I would ultimately say about what I was thinking about this and how I could address the folks in this camp of like the jazz artist. When I go to a jazz concert, and sit there as a non-jazz aficionado, I feel like that most of the show is for the people that are up on stage. It's them really like, this is how much I can solo. This is how proficient I am at my instrument. It feels like a lot of it is for them to enjoy themselves and those few people that are right there with them, understanding how difficult what they're doing is. But for someone like myself, when I hear them like just take some space, play some melodies, I'm like, oh, now they're inviting me into this. I feel like I'm engaged a little bit more.
And I think when we're thinking about
this episode, I just offended every jazz artist that listens to this podcast.
It's about the moment and surprise and innovation. And yeah. To continue speaking as some, I mean, I'm into jazz, but to consider the person who isn't, I mean, lots of non-jazz fans love the Miles Davis kind of blue record. Like that's kind of the cliche standard for what jazz is for people who don't often listen to jazz. And even that record, although it definitely has like a vibe, it's full of variation. Like it starts off with a very modal kind of mid-tempo-y track, and then it goes to like a sort of bluesy shuffle, and there's like a flamenco inspired ballady kind of thing. And then there's like all the impressionistic piano, like minimalist kind of stuff. So that from song to song, there's quite a bit of change and dynamics. And what gives it, I think, the cohesiveness is simply that it's the same five or six, I forget, players with the same instruments, basically making a record over a couple days. So the people brought the cohesiveness, but they scripted it out so that there would be change from tempo and feel and groove. And I guess they didn't really play with instrumentation, that's the thing that gave it its cohesiveness. But, you know, I feel like there's a lot of ways you can play with that in your set list, like being conscious of too many major key songs in a row or too many minor key songs, moving from maybe more sophisticated to simple stuff, like especially with jazz, like if you have some crazy improvisational freak out, like follow it up with a song that's almost through composed and or not through composed, but fully composed and has a riff or a hook that gets repeated a lot. And
yeah,
you know, keep people not pleased. I know that's not the point of jazz. You know what
that
I mean.
That was the point I just made a few minutes ago.
consider the way in which you're bringing up about their displeasure in a pleasurable way.
No, I was thinking that, you know, I can't remember a jazz concert that I've been to, and I've been to quite a few, but I can't remember having gone to one where, like, a song starts and the drummer and the bass player and everyone's just grooving without it being like someone soloing. And like laying down a groove, not like running scales up and down the neck, but like everyone's just grooving on that for a while. I'm sure it happens. I haven't been to that many yet, but that kind of stuff to me makes it feel a little bit more accessible and adds space. To me, the ultimately
a fear of space.
I feel like when I see jazz shows, there's not that space and that openness that you would experience with some other types of music. And as a listener, it can start to feel challenging, especially for a longer show. I think the idea, if you're putting together a jazz set list, having a version of a cover song that's a popular cover song, even then, but, you know, that hits that theme, but then you solo over, that could be really cool. And that would grab me right away. You know, even taking some time to talk about the songs or whatever. I don't see a lot of the jazz shows I've been to them taking time to just explain why that song means something to them or why they chose it. A lot of times it's just, these are jazz standards, so we're playing jazz standards. So I think that's something that can be added in as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I feel like there might be even more of an opportunity for banter for jazz musicians because they're not already eating up like that language space with lyrics and singing. And so sometimes when you're talking about a song that has words, you risk over-explaining it. And then mm-hmm. by the time you play the song and sing it, people are like, all right, you're kind of just, I just heard you say all this. What's the point of me listening now? With jazz, it, you know, I guess I know there's vocal jazz, but if it's instrumental, like, I feel like people want to hear from the artist almost even more.
Yeah. You know, whenever I'm at a jazz show, there's something I always get fixated on. Why don't they let the drummer play the dang kick drum? They always have these amazing drummers and they don't let them hit the drums. They make them do this swishy noise on a snare drum that I could do myself. And I'll just sit there and fix, hit the kick drum. Why can't we have a downbeat? Why can't we have the beat that like the kick on this? Hit the kick drum. And then it'll come in once and I'll feel like a little, I'll be like, yay, they hit the kick drum.
Well, don't you know it's because they're trying to duplicate live the inferior recording technology of the 40s through 60s?
Some of the jazz drummers are the best drummers ever, and I love listening to drummers, and that's why I fixate on it, because I'm like, I want to hear this guy play. Let him play. I could get up there and swish on that snare, and no one would care. Anyway, we move on.
You should do a blog post about 10 things that are wrong with jazz from someone who doesn't really like jazz.
I like a good jazz record. I just don't have it in heavy rotation for, I think, obvious reasons that we have just discussed.
Yes.
Oh, but I think Austin was looking for that honest feedback.
Yeah. Well, clearly.
So
I don't know if he was looking for our feedback, but he was looking for... Well, no, he was looking for our feedback. He wrote our podcast.
Yeah, he emailed us.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, I didn't find this on Twitter.
We should start doing that, answering random music questions on. I was going to say that a lot of the things that I said about creating variation in your set, like keys, major, minor stuff, tempos and grooves, like obviously that applies to all bands, all genres, like because if you don't, you will... it's not like your audience is going to say, hey, this is in A major and that last one was in A major. They don't know that, but subconsciously they know it. Or they might sort of detect a sameness and monotony.
Yeah. Let's move along and hit a few more things. And because I want to make sure we get to those listener questions and calls. With the 20 to 25 minute set, that seems like a really short set. The largest tour we did opening for somebody, we did a 90 city tour where we were the opening act, and we had a 25 minute set. Actually, when we started the tour, it was supposed to be 20 minutes, but our record was breaking and selling more than the headliner. And so they gave us 25 minutes. That can be a very powerful segment of music if you plan it out. That's actually when our label hired Tom Jackson and worked with us to create that set. And I came across a video of it just this past year, and it's still, I was amazed at how powerful and that the transitions we had and how meaty that 25 minutes of music was. And we didn't ignore the audience. We still said things, but it really killed. So you can do an excellent job here. And I think sometimes these shorter sets are the hardest ones, that diving into some of that Tom Jackson material can be important. But, you know, typically people are just playing their band's hits in this kind of segment. But I don't think you should approach it as like, oh, we just have 25 minutes, just get up there and phone it in, because it can be very powerful.
So let me ask you the questions then, since you've done many of those. How did you make the decisions, and what was the band's decisions, and then where did Tom Jackson come in and tweak things?
Well, we knew we had to play certain songs because we had songs being promoted to radio right then. So I think we ended up playing, I think we were able to squeeze in 5 songs. And so we wanted to have like a feel. So it came out a certain way and had that energy. And then we also did some arrangement tweaks to the song to make them feel more fun and have those moments in there. And we ended, you know, with the big high energy. So it was more high energy than a normal Small Town Poets set. But we did play a mid-tempo, I guess you might call it a ballad, but this one song that was really mellow. And so it was really a lot of work to make it work together and hit all those things quickly and it not feel like we were rushing. But it was a really great 25 minutes. So I think you can do a good job with this. You know, if it's something that you're just doing one night, like, oh, we got an opening slot, you want to get on it? You know, I would say, depending on who you're playing with, you just pick the songs that are going to be the most fun, work well, represent the band the best. But if you're going to be doing it night after night, I really think this is where you can take some time and craft something that was really cool. The thing that was that when we got done playing that 25-minute set, it felt like we'd played a whole show because it had those moments. They went by really fast, but it had those moments. Then when we were playing shows on our own in between and had to play for an hour and a half, it felt like, oh my gosh, how do you play for an hour and a half again?
When you did the short 25-minute one, did you do that cover song medley or any cover songs, or it was all originals?
No, that was all originals.
Yeah, you just...
No. That cover song medley is about 9 minutes long. So it
would have been half, a third of your set time. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was when our album was, our debut album had been out for about 6 months. And so it was really starting to break. And so that was really our first major tour opening for somebody else. And so we had to play the hits, and there was, you know, that there was some, the label had thoughts about our set list in that case, but it can be done. So I think really the advice I'd give is don't just think it as a throwaway set of like, oh, I can't do anything interesting and cool in 25 minutes. You absolutely can. You just probably have to think about it more. The 45 minute set list, I think, is ones that we encounter a lot. And the one that I would, some things to think about here, and we had some notes that are outside of just the songs, but this is where, to me, it's like some of the decisions start coming, being decided by like production. And well, when we play an hour and a half, we have time for all those guitar changes and moving things around or stuff like that. But when we're playing 45 minutes, sometimes the reducing guitar changes sometimes dictates the set to make it more efficient and the flow, so we're not fumbling around on stage for 5 minutes in a 45-minute set. So those are things to consider.
Right, and all of those production things, inhibit, not necessarily in a bad way, but they inhibit your ability to change the set too.
Yes.
If, you know, someone's got to go into an alternate tuning and they don't have a guitar, they actually need to tune it. Well, that's the time for the singer to go up and start talking and doing some banter or whatever. And like, I don't know, there's just less flexibility, but that could be fine if it's an amazing production and the right set. So.
Yeah. So like we played this club gig in Seattle back in the fall. And our set was short enough and there was production restraints. It was, you know, typical club. There's like five microphones. We got to figure out who gets them. It wasn't that bad. It was actually, and it's been an amazing night. But we had to, the set was short enough where there was only one song where our lead singer was going to play that had played electric guitar on, but we just cut that. He didn't play electric on it for that show because it just didn't make sense to keep it in the set. We kept the song in the set, but had to make the call that it didn't make sense to use that time, him throwing on electric guitar, killing all the momentum, and then taking electric guitar off
right.
for one song. So some of those things come into consideration with this. I think the 45-minute set, I always think that if I'm playing a club gig, even if it's, you know, I'm opening for somebody or it's our show, but I'm still up and coming, it's not all our audience, I tend to use the first song as something that I don't want to play a hit there. I want to have something that is catchy, higher on the energy side, but something that if people aren't paying attention, I'm not going to have my feelings hurt. That's usually how I craft it and then start building it in a way where there's the songs that I really want people to be more engaged with later on. And I think the 45-minute set is the opportunity. Swap this around as much as possible. If you're playing a lot of shows, try out different things and see what works and what doesn't. There'll be some nights where you put together a set list and you're like, that did not work. The flow didn't feel right. The energy was all over the place. So I think that set list is a good one to test some segments and things to see what songs fit best together.
Yeah. I have, as an audience member, I have a preference for sets. I don't know why this is, but I really like concerts that begin with like slow dramatic builds of the first song. And it doesn't, maybe the song doesn't have to be slow, but sparse and mysterious and slowly accruing energy and building to some dramatic point. And then if that's the first song, then the next two being kind of deliberately high energy, more upbeat. And then maybe going back to a ballad or something. Or if you don't start with the kind of slow build one, do the two high energy ones off the bat, assuming they're not like your hits, your biggest hits or whatever, and then go to the more mysterious one. I like that 2-to-1 kind of balance.
Yes. And one thing about set lists, and this is one of my biggest pet peeves with bands, is you should absolutely mark some spots where you force a stop and you address the crowd.
Yes.
My biggest pet peeve is when, and there, this happened not too long ago, I was there at a show. I was really digging the band and not once did they say who they were. And it made me so mad because I'm like, I'm not so hard up for music that I need to go scour the web and figure out who you were. I liked what you were doing. I had Spotify in my pocket. I was about to pull it out and search your name and check it out later. But I just moved on with my life. So I think I see bands do this all the time. I've been in the bands that do this. We're like, no, we'll just stop where, you know, we'll figure it out where it makes sense. And then what they're really saying is we don't want to because either we're embarrassed or we don't think it's cool. But put those stopping points in the set and force some stopping points where you can address the audience, give their ears a chance to breathe, and then also, just if you do anything, please tell them who you are.
Right.
I don't care if you don't give them a giant sales pitch. It's your missed opportunity if you don't, you know, get them connected to your music somehow. But please, at least say who you are and, you know, address them. It's not a rehearsal space that some random people wandered into and are watching you rehearse. Address them like they are the audience. That's all I ask.
Yeah.
Please.
And I said this earlier, but like write those moments on your set list and plug them in the places where you know ahead of time that, well, the drummer needs to switch his sample or the guitar player needs to change his guitar or whatever. There's these moments where there's instrument transitions or anything like that, like perfect time to talk to the audience and let them breathe and let your band breathe.
Let me just ask one rapid fire, Chris.
Okay.
Tell me some tips and tricks for keeping that 2-hour original gig interesting, and how you manage 2 hours, because it's hard to build like have this like big buildup, or you know, like the Tom Jackson pattern for a show that gets a little more challenged when you have 2 hours and it may not be, you know, you're not Bruce Springsteen in an arena where people are going to hang out for 4 hours until you, you know, play Born in the USA. What are some tips and strategies for putting together a set list for like 2 hours of original? I have never done one of these shows either because I've never been in a band that
had that much material.
Small Town Poets does now.
It does have enough material.
But I'm thinking about Hello Morning when I was playing the gigs here in Portland a lot. Mm-hmm. We did not have 2 hours worth of material. We actually turned down a few gigs because they were like, you must play for 2 hours. I'm like, no, I'm sorry.
Well, let's see. I think in the same way that you could have production elements like scene changes and costume changes, like those are like, very overt ways of changing things. But you could almost have a similar attitude about the mood of the show, and like maybe a couple songs are really focused on the drumming and then maybe a couple songs focus on the singer, and then, you know, like shift the audience's focus across the different players throughout the night. Same thing with moods of songs. Maybe there's a couple songs that are really sort of fun and silly and not taking themselves too seriously. And then that turns into just kind of a darker, more concentrated thing. So yeah, basically just shifting the mood in that way. I love when towards the end of a show, the band like puts their instruments down, or maybe they go like entirely acoustic and they step up to the front of the stage or even into the audience and they, you know, perform without any electricity at all. And it feels very like this human connection. That's just, you know, you spent this time with these people, you love them, and now you can love them even more because they're like coming to you. That's awesome. Yeah, I guess also, like I mentioned, production stuff. Don't necessarily feel like your music has to do all the talking. You could maybe have some films projected onto screens and light changes, like even like subtle light changes. If you can get someone to have access to the faders of the lights and stuff, that can make a big difference. Props on stage can be cool. I guess they can be really awkward too, but they don't need to be like high budget because, you know, and Stop Making Sense, David Byrne dances with a lamp. We all own lamps.
You've got your toilet bowl cleaner.
Yeah, right. For my live stream, Flula the Alpaca. Let's see. Oh yeah. We talked about making sure the singer tells some stories here and there. Don't just run.
I always love it when people break things up with an acoustic set. I just think it adds an element of such a dynamic change. It's a nice break for the ears. If it's a rock band, it's a nice break for the ears. It's also, it just, the energy is so different. And then it doesn't feel like, I think for me, a lot of it is keeping the energy moving, because even if it's like high energy, you can only go so high energy. Like 2 hours of high energy is going to start to feel just like a flat line after a while. So
yeah, totally. I know this isn't the exact kind of show you're talking about, but like with like a tribute show, like the Peter Gabriel one we did, and there's one that happens in Portland, Oregon every winter. That's a White Album Christmas. It's the White Album. Like in those things, you know what the set list is ahead of time, because in a lot of ways it's dictated by the source material, by the band you're covering or the album you're covering. But there's still considerations about, I think, intermissions. With the Peter Gabriel one, I think we did like 45 minutes, and then we took a 15 minute break and then did another 45 minutes. And then actually, I can't remember if we did an encore or not. I think we did. Yeah, we did two songs as an encore.
We did.
And then like with the White Album, they do side one and two, take a break. They do side three and four, take a little break. And then they come out and do 3 or 4 Beatles songs that aren't on the White Album. Every year that changes. But, you know, just little things like that to give everyone a break is important, even when, for the most part, the show's very scripted in terms of the set list.
Yeah. Well, you've got one tip on that you wrote in the notes, that's referring to the 2-hour or like a long set list, like could apply to the cover song one. Write a set list and then right next to it, have your song list and be ready to pull songs from the song list you hadn't planned to play.
Yes.
I like that because, you know, we've talked a lot about reading the room. And I think in the situation of Austin's original email about the jazz group, I think, you know, because he asked if you should have a set list that's the same every night. I think when you go on tour, a lot of times you'll see bands take a variety of methods. Like it could be totally different every night. It could be exactly the same, or they might swap out a song or two. But I think if you, there's things when you see happening in the room, you're like, oh, this, I should go to this song instead. I think that's important. I think like having that list there is a good visual reminder because in the moment you might be, your mind might go blank. Like what songs do I know that aren't on this list where there you go. Oh yeah, I could jump to that one. That would be a good one.
Yeah. And not like you want your set list to look like a flow chart or anything, but you could potentially build in options into your set list. Like, you know, if,
what are you doing? Math up there.
If we get to this point in the show and it's still dead, like here's two other options we could take. Yeah.
It's a choose your own adventure.
It is, yeah.
Are they throwing beer bottles? Yes. Okay, play this song. Wagon wheel it is.
You win, wagon wheel.
But I think that's a good tip. I was following, if I've mentioned on the podcast back in the fall, I was really into the latest Death Cab for Cutie album and went and saw them live and was checking out online their set lists and it's interesting how there's certain segments of their set, which is a 2-hour set, where they're constantly swapping stuff, but then there's like the solid songs that they know these are going to be the last three, or this is going to be like the 3-4-5-6, combo. So that was pretty interesting to see that, you know, there's these pieces that they know they want, and then they're swapping in songs from their catalog that kind of fill in the same vibe, I'd say. And they're probably just songs they'd like to play. And they might have been, you know, might be experimenting and just trying to figure out, you know, wanting to keep it fresh.
Yeah, that's cool.
I know Pearl Jam does that a lot too.
It's been kind of a while since I did consistent shows with a full band, but like, I think we used to do something like that. There'd be like the three songs you knew you were always going to play back to back and then other things could change.
Yes. And I was at a Switchfoot show recently and people started yelling songs from the audience and they actually were playing them and none of them were on that night's set list.
Oh, that's cool too. Yeah.
And so that's always something that it's like, as a band, do you know your whole catalog enough? Even the songs that are most popular enough, even the old ones, just in case there's that moment where it's worth pulling out and making the crowd really happy.
Well, and that's the key to having the song list next to the set list is like, you know, if you're going to be able to pull something from the song list, not like you have to rehearse it all the time, but it should be kind of like fresh enough that you can pull it out spontaneously. And then I did have a tip I've said on this show in the past. It's kind of the opposite of a pro tip, if there's such a thing, which is that, sometimes people are like, how the hell can you play like a 5-hour show with no breaks and like remember all those lyrics? And the answer is I don't. I just, with like modern pop, really, if you just know the first verse, anytime the verse comes around, you can just repeat those lyrics and like 90% of the people in the audience won't even notice.
That's pretty accurate. Pretty accurate.
I mean, special, and I should be fairer to myself. I really only do that with like the very high energy, dancey songs, like things like By the Weeknd, and I guess I don't even do it with Katy Perry. I know all her lyrics, but just certain modern dance songs. I'm like, it doesn't really matter if I just repeat the same thing three times because everyone's just dancing and singing along anyways. They don't care.
My last question about this whole set list thing is, when do you prepare for an encore? I think every band I've been in and played with has debated this. And what songs do you set aside for that encore? Because if you're thinking, oh, we're not going to have an encore, and you play all the songs or you play the hit you would normally save for the encore, then what?
Right. That's interesting. Yeah. Do you hold back the best stuff risking that it never comes around because no one claps.
Yeah, and then everybody's like, screw these guys, and they all leave. And you're like, well, I guess they're not going to hear the good stuff. I will say for us, part of the reason why we would debate it is being in the Christian market, we played a lot of churches. Newer churches now are built just like theaters and are equipped for concerts. There's little difference if you walked into a church. That might surprise you listening to this, but the average newer church building looks just like a concert venue and has usually better production, probably some of the best production in your city. When we were playing, touring nonstop, that was just starting to happen. But a lot of times we'd be playing on a church stage and the side door was really just the choir room that didn't go anywhere. So people that went to that church would be like, why did the band just leave the stage and all go in the choir room? And now they're stuck in there or the closet, the equipment closet, because there's, you know, there wasn't a side stage or backstage, I should say. And so that's why part of the time we'd be like, we look kind of stupid. There's no place for us to go. And so for a while, Michael would started saying in those situations, you know, we could pretend till the show was over and go through the door, which is really just a janitor's closet, and pretend that and stand in the closet and wait for you guys to cheer. Or we can just play you a couple more songs. Do you want to hear a couple more songs?
And then I imagine they're all very good natured and clapped and wanted to hear more.
Yes, because my feeling is that human beings just like to know when the end is coming. It's not that they love the concert so much that they need more. It's just that the show ended, but I didn't have a heads up that that was the last song. So now that I know we're near the end, I want two more songs so I can make peace with the show coming to an end. That's
a great point. And yeah, you know, I played this bookstore last month. And it was billed as like a storytelling event. So, you know, like it was a concert, but I was sort of expected to talk about all the songs. And it was a very, very intimate venue. Like it was basically the equivalent of a house show. My wife was dreading it. She hates folk music. She hates lyric-driven stuff. She hates singers talking about their songs. She hates being super close to you. So you can like...
Do you have to practice when she's not in the house?
No, but I notice I do my live streams when she's at work. No, she doesn't hate my music, or at least not all of it. But she was dreading this because it's her least favorite kind of show. Not just for me, for anyone. She hates these kind of shows. Yeah. And she's like, are you going to do any upbeat stuff or covers? I'm like, nope, that's not what this is for. This one's for me to tell my, you know, like, and so I went and did the show. She went, it was all depressing songs, like an hour and a half of my most depressing, dark, slow stuff. People were crying in the audience. They were with me every step of the way. It was awesome. It was very rewarding. But I did that thing of saying, I've got about five more songs. I think I'll play two more. Okay, this is going to be my last one. And so afterwards, she said, I was completely wrong. That was amazing. Like, you should continue to do those types of things. I will dread them less. And she said what made her...
I will dread your music a little bit less.
And well, I think what she was saying is like what made a difference for her is not just that the material was successful in that environment and the, you know, people were connecting with it, but because if they're not, the hyper intimacy can be so awkward and then people feel like they're indebted to stay there when they don't want to. But also, like what you're saying is setting the expectation for when something is going to end. I think she felt freed of some kind of mysterious burden by knowing, okay, he's got about 20 more minutes. Okay, there's three more, whatever. Like, so just knowing there was an exit door made her want to stay, and she was moved by it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, it's like the whole second half of the concert experience, they're really in the groove. Some may want to go like, this is starting to feel long, but it ends like, oh, okay, I'm excited. I want to enjoy a little bit more of them now that I know it's going to be over. Or I can't quite yet deal with the fact this is coming to an end. Please just play two more songs. So, yeah. Anyway, I would love to get everyone's thoughts on how they put together their set list, any tips, tricks, or things that they do, how their band goes about deciding the set list every night. You can call our listening line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And I'd love to hear what people say.
You know, I just thought of one more quick tip, which on the subject of encores, if you're the opener, don't encore, even if the crowd is cheering. I've only done it once in my life, and it was because we were at the Doug Fir, and the former singer of your former band, Henry, looked over who he was in the next band. I forget if it was a Hello Morning thing or if it was Jonah or what, but he looked over from the wings and he was like, go for it, play some more. So then I had his permission. So we played like another song, I think, and then got off. But otherwise, yeah, I would never have done an encore as an opening band.
Absolutely. That's happened a few times and it's infuriating, especially in a club type setup where, you have 45, 45, 45 of the set list. So basically hour chunks with a, 15-minute set time in there. And you're just eating into the other band's time. And that's infuriating. Because now they have to either make the decision to be the ass that plays late and causes the headliner to go till one or something else. Yeah. That happened to us. Oh, one of our worst Hello Morning gigs. Loden was at 4. I think we finally got on the stage at 12:30.
Wow, yeah.
Partly because the band, we were the headliners, but the band that was playing before us, they had a lot of fans there. So they felt like that meant it was instantly their show and they could do what they wanted. And instead of, I think they started late. They definitely played long. They played like 15 minutes long and then they did an encore. And so we were going on to like at 12:30 while 10 people watched and the rest of the crew cleaned the place.
Oh my
it
God.
Was agonizing. So don't do that. Don't do that. Have respect for the other artists that are on the bill and keep your set list appropriate and measure the time appropriately. All right. We've got a couple emails and a call. And so let's jump into those now. Hey, Kevin and Chris, Jeremy here from Space Moose again. I said it right, Jeremy. I promise I'm not stalking you, really. You mentioned us for a third time in your podcast, number 232. So I had to write and say thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I also wanted to say you're absolutely right about the difficulty with our name, something we are aware of, but it has such sentimental significance for us, we had to go with it. That said, I thought I'd share what we are doing about it. On our website, in addition to videos, song links, and information about the band, we also have a weekly serialized blog that tells the tale of Space Moose. We are currently up to chapter 10, and it has really helped our fans acclimate to the strange word with a stranger spelling. We've only been a band a few months, and the blog has gotten us hundreds of hits on the website and is helping us grow our social media profile as well. People seem to love this ongoing crazy story about a moose from space. In addition to the blog, we also have a page on the website that tells the real story behind the name. And I have had people tell me they like that even better than my absurd ramblings about an oversized elk in a spacesuit. Go figure. Anyway, thank you again for the mentions and your kind words. We have our third single coming out on June 7th, along with another crazy video. Hopefully, I'll see you in Austin, Jeremy from Space Moose. So I thought that was interesting that he wrote back in. So now, Jeremy, now you've got 4 podcast mentions. You better be in Austin. That's all I have to say. I thought that was interesting that he followed up with the fact that acknowledging the challenges I brought up, but how they were dealing with it. And I thought the way they were dealing with it was clever. It's still spelt differently than it sounds, but I think the way they're drawing people into the story and their logo is a moose in a spacesuit, people probably catch on pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, living in Maine, I am interested in outer space moose. That is intriguing to me. I had an idea for him, which I think there's a singer-songwriter named Mark Arelli that I really like that, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, he shared this video on YouTube of someone saying, you know, those pronunciation videos, like how to pronounce flambé. And then they just pronounce it. And that's like, it's a 6-second long video. Someone was pronouncing his name And it looked like one of those legitimate pronunciation YouTube channels. Like, it wasn't like, I don't think it was like a fan doing it as a joke. Or so that was kind of intriguing. Like, how's this, you know, singer-songwriter getting his name pronounced it? But they could do that for Space Moose. They could have a joke version of those pronunciation videos.
Yeah, if you make it fun website. And entertaining, people will think it's funny. And it'll stick in their head. So, yeah. Well, thanks for sharing, Jeremy. I thought that was a good advice that other people might get some inspiration from. All right, let's play the call. We've got a call, and here we go.
Hi there. My name's Joy Hanna, and I recently discovered the DIY Musician podcast and have been loving listening to all the different tips, and yeah, it's just really a great resource. So thank you for that. I was wondering, in regards to pitching songs, would you recommend joining a songwriting / pitching organization like TACSI, National Songwriter Association Incorporated, NSAI, or would it be better to do some research and contact a music licensing or publishing company directly, or both? Just wanted to know if you could speak to the effectiveness of these different approaches. Thanks so much. Bye.
I have some thoughts. I don't know if you have thoughts, Chris, but I definitely do.
I'm glad you have thoughts. Because
even on this topic,
mine would be ill-formed at best.
Well, I don't know that I've met anybody who's done a songwriter contest and felt like it did anything for them, but I have known people that have used TACSI, lots of them. Some people have had great experiences. Some have felt like they didn't get what they paid for. But typically with those types of situations, I feel like the disconnect maybe isn't in the service itself, because I know what TACSI does. They sort of are a go-between between you and music supervisors. But really, to me, if you're going to pay for a service, and anyway, even just pitching to a service, you need to do that self-assessment first. Is your music something that will get placed in film and TV? Meaning, does it sound like what you're hearing on TV shows? If you're not watching TV shows and don't know what the kind of music they're using sounds like, you need to start there. So if your music does line up, because there are some specific things that tend to find their way to TV shows and film, if the answer is yes, then I think all those options could be an option for you. Ultimately, I think the best results you're going to get is by getting a licensing company that has a smaller catalog that can focus on your music. That's how you're going to get the most placements. That doesn't mean it's the only way. Doesn't mean a place with a big catalog is bad. But so it could be using something like TACSI. If you've done that self-assessment and think it's worth the money, it can be a foot in the door. It could be, you know, searching for a licensing agent at the same time. And you got to search for people that are needing music, like licensing companies. A lot of them specialize in types of music. So you need to make sure you're not knocking on the wrong door. So do some online digging and research. It's not super hard. A weekend of Googling and you'll have lots to work with. And if you're unwilling to do that, then maybe someone else gets that placement.
Guess that's the that's the lesson of all sync licensing right there.
Yeah. And by the way, I should mention that we have a sync licensing department here at CD Baby. We don't publicize it as much as we should, and we will. I'll talk to the marketing department and get them on that. We actually have two full-time people pitching, and we've been getting a ton of placements for artists, big placements, commercials, TV, film. And all you have to do to get in that program is once you distribute through CD Baby, you just check a box that you want your music included. And we have a whole website called cdbabylicensing.com that is an interface that music supervisors are using to search and find music that fits their need. And We've been licensing a ton of it. And we have plans to start publicizing that more. But that's one of the ways we're helping you make more money from your music and not just saying we do something. We're actually doing it. So be sure you're a part of that. Well, I hope that answers your question, Joy. And thanks for the call. And let's go to our last email. Hey, guys, I love your show. And I've been listening to the podcast from the beginning, even the ones from the MySpace days. When I saw the new episode on choosing your band name, I had to give it a listen, and I'm currently in the process of naming my new music project. The name we decided on is Beta Twin. Two words, Beta Twin. We liked the phonetic clarity and the punch of the name, but also the underdog-esque, they made up a word there, underdog-esque poetic imagery of the name. We came up with this name because we are a two-person band, hence Twin, and we are going for a retro 80s electronic sound, hence Beta. So everything seems perfect. I went through your list of things to consider, and we met almost all of the requirements, but I'd like your thoughts on the issues I found. Firstly, I searched Google, Apple, Spotify, and every music service I could and didn't see a band called Beta Twin. I even searched the trademark office and didn't see any registration. The first problem we had is betatwin.com is taken by a company who forwards the URL to their website, bwin.com. Upon further investigation, they had bought betatwin.com as well as playatwin.com. Since they have a completely different company name, bwin, we decided to use betatwinmusic.com. Do you think we would also need to secure betatwinofficial.com, or would it be worth it to try and buy Beta Twin domain from them? They've owned it since 2003, so I would think the odds would be low. The other problem I heard you raise was, is the name similar to another product? Naturally, when you search the words Beta Twin on Google, it comes up with moms on forums discussing the beta levels of HCG in twin babies. So no problem there. The only potential problem I found was a mechanical clamp. It's called a beta clamp twin series because it has two holes. So beta clamp twin series. In terms of SEO, I'm pretty confident that our band would rise to the top of these search results. Any advice you could give would be much appreciated. I have a tendency to get caught up in the details, which is why I grabbed the domain when I could. However, there's always the nagging feeling of perfection when I wonder if the name will cause problems down the road. In short, do you think we need a different band name, or are these just small problems that can be worked around? And this is from Kelsey. I emailed Kelsey back, and first of all, I don't think any of these are issues.
I completely agree. And I love the band name, by the way. But,
yeah, I thought it was a good band name. The one thing I told Kelsey that it highlighted was the fact that one of the things that we didn't mention is that if your band name is multiple words and you put it together, it might spell something else and make that URL desirable for a different reason. So someone bought that URL because Beta Twin, if you break it up, also sells Bet a Win or something. What was it? Yeah. Bet at Win. So like people that are gambling online, I guess. So that was interesting. Not much of a concern there, but just something that might be an annoyance. Not worth changing the band name, though. And I don't think it's that big of an annoyance here. I'm just saying with a particular band, you might find that to be an annoying thing that the word could be broken up into something else that makes the URL harder to get.
Yeah. I know there's a British band, I forget if they're called Beta Band or Beta Band. I don't know how they pronounce it, but like that would be like maybe some small confusion, but I doubt it. Like Beta Twin is like enough of its own thing that I also feel like once they get going and establish a presence in terms of SEO, that would beat out an appearance of some product that happens to have both those words in its description. Just a guess, but I don't think there's search problems there.
No, I don't think I told them that they should move forward with it. However, the one piece of feedback I will give, I don't know how old Kelsey is. And I lived through the era of having the Betamax, and that's not where my brain went. Beta is also the word people use that are, people are more common with that or more familiar with that word being used with like beta testing, the beta version, meaning like the version that's not quite ready or the version that's in testing. So like if you're in the computer world, the beta version is always the version that you're saying it's out there, people can use it, but there's going to be bugs and problems and it's not its official release. So more people's brain these days might go to that. They may not have the retro connection. So I think you're going to need to lean on the imagery to pull on that
D80s
retro connection.
Yeah.
If that's the direction you're going, because some people might think of it, oh, this is the first twin, the one that was just a test until the second twin came
out. Well, that kind of, however you read it, I think there's something there because it plays on some sort of cloning, development and cloning sort of thing. That's at least where my mind went, which seemed kind of like retro sci-fi anyways. So,
okay.
Like even if it is.
I like the name. Yeah. I like the name. I think it's a good name, especially since, you know, yeah, it's so hard to find a short name with two words, but yeah, I thought it was good.
And good that it's twin and it's a duo, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, perfect.
Yeah.
Well,
see, we're doing good in the world.
I think that's, yeah. So far, no frustrated emails after the name episode, but we've been getting a lot of response from that episode. That's a big struggle for artists. And it's only going to get worse. Like I said, I don't know what people 50 years from now are going to do if the internet's still around because nothing dies anymore.
The band name's going to be like UST111718-4.
Yeah, it's going to be like reading barcodes. Oh, I love that band. Yeah. All right. Well, if you have a comment or question and want to call in or write in, you can do so 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And, you know, you might just end up on the podcast. And if you're like Space Moose, you might end up on it four times. Jeremy, the challenge is if you can contribute something to make it on a fifth time. That might be an all-time record. I don't know. I haven't been keeping track, but.
Hey, you know, we did hear from a former podcast co-host, Chris Bolton. What did we call him back then? The Bolt. We heard from him recently. He has launched a updated version of a website called, should we tell everyone? Nifty Buttons.
Sure, Nifty Buttons. Yeah, we probably talked about it on the podcast way back in the day.
It's basically social platform icons, but in various design styles.
Yeah, so you can grab them easily. Yeah. Yeah, that was out of the blue. He's still alive. He's still out there. Yeah. All right. DIYMusicianCon.com. Go get your tickets and distribute your music at CD Baby. Come on. Let's get it together. Sync licensing is just one of the many things we're doing. We're actually doing. We have real employees. We don't just say it on the website. We have real employees making your music make money and earn more. So yeah, we'll have to talk about what we're doing on YouTube. Our YouTube monetization is pretty nice. Pretty nice.
I sense a future episode about all that modern distribution really should entail.
Exactly. First, it should entail real people behind it, not just words on a website.
And
anyway, I digress, ideally
it would also involve you actually getting paid as a artist.
Yeah, that's most important. Yeah, getting paid is also probably critical, but anyway, we hope to see you in Austin August 16th through 18th, we'll do a live taping of the podcast. You can hang out with Chris and I, or Chris and I can hang out with you. That's what I will say. It's about us spending time with you. So come to Austin. Right now, tickets are $129. That will be going up. Jeremy from Space Moose, he says he's going to be there.
He's locked in.
So he's locked in. And DIYMusicianCon.com, we'll see you there. And that's going to do it for this podcast. See ya.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.